Today, as Mabel said, my name is Wanda Nowicka. I'm coordinating the regional network ASTRA, Central Eastern European Women's Network for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights. We are having a very huge room, so I would like to invite those who sit in the very end to come over, so to try to make it more cozy a space for us. And as Mabel said, we would like our session to be very interactive. So without further ado, I would like to ask the first speaker. And our first speaker is going to be Sifive Hlofer from ICD. I probably pronounced not very well. You will correct me.
Okay.
And you and Sifive is from ICW Global with SWAPO, Swaziland for Positive Living. And yes, okay, and welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Sipiwe Hlophe from Swaziland. Swaziland Positive Living. It's my organization where I'm working. And I'm in ICW, the vice chairperson of ICW. We are, I would say, I'm very much happy. Okay. I would say I'm very much happy to talk about the issues of sexual and reproductive rights, especially basing the rights to women living with HIV and AIDS. It is very saddening that every time we are in the conference, we're talking about women's rights, women's rights. In the morning when we were launching the Women Arise, I said, maybe it's high time we don't talk about the rights, we make actions. Sometimes we can seal our mouth like this, and then we make action so that we can be heard about the issues of women's rights, because it has been long. And another one I was sitting next to, she said to me, Spiwe, you have been talking about women's rights. If we can get a billionaire who can say, how much do you want in order to promote for the women's rights? What can you say? And then I laughed. I said, this is the question I would be asking the House in the afternoon. If we can just get a billionaire and say, this is the money for women's rights, how much can we say we want? Nevertheless, I'm talking about reproductive rights, sexual and reproductive rights for women. One of the rights that we are actually advocating as women living with HIV and AIDS is quality access to health services. If I say quality, I don't mean what is happening now in Africa, whereby they would say, come in, Spiwe next, come in, Spiwe next. We need equality. We need quality treatment, especially in Africa. There is this problem now of cervical cancer outbreak, whereby as women living with HIV and AIDS, we need all facilities to make sure that the cervical cancer is being addressed. We have the issue of MDR. MDR is a new drug for a TB it's just a new drug whereby you become resistant to TB, but we need that to be in place as women living with HIV and AIDS, because sometimes we develop drugs, we develop TB, and then when we have developed TB, and then there is this resistance that we will be experiencing or coming. And then we need to have quality treatment to make sure, be it in STI, to make sure that we are healthy because we are also human being. Nobody should be asking why at 52 you are HIV positive. That is the issue we should be looking at. We need the treatment more than the questions that were being asked from the health centers. The prevention methods that are there, that is our right as women living with HIV and AIDS. The number of children I want to have, but right now in Africa, you depend on your male partner to say, how many children do you want to have? Or the health workers would find that as an HIV positive woman, you are no more supposed to have children. For instance, in Namibia, we have a problem right now where there is this forced sterilization of young women who are HIV positive. And then we are saying, where is their right to have children? If the health ministry is sterilizing them. And then also the right to safe abortion. I know most of the countries, they don't want to talk about safe abortion. I don't know whether it's criminal or whether it's ungodly or what. But as women, that is our right to have a safe abortion. If I want to have a child, if I don't want to have a child, I must have that right. Also to practice safe sex, not to depend on the partner. If that partner wants to use condoms or not. It is our right as women living with HIV and AIDS to practice safe sex, to choose. And then the other thing, to choose which partner you want to engage on sexuality. In the African countries, the lesbians are not allowed. If you are in this world of LGBTs, you are more than a criminal, you are more than a killer or more than a thief. It's something that is illegal. We have seen Malawi, whereby they convicted these young men because they were engaging in practices or unsocial norms that are not actually accepted to the country. They needed an external pressure in order to release them from the prison. But I said, although they can be freed from the prison, but they remain convicts for the rest of their life because their rights are not actually recognized in Malawi. So if they are not recognized, their rights are not recognized in Malawi, they remain convicts until they die. We need these rights to be practiced in our country. The other thing is the meaningful involvement of women living with HIV and AIDS. I heard in this morning they were talking about meaningful involvement of women. But if we talk about meaningful involvement of women, we mean full participation in all the programs that are there or that are initiated for women. Two, we mean empowerment of women in order to actually participate meaningfully. We need women to be having a full knowledge on policies, on legislations, on HIV and AIDS. That knowledge is needed so that the women can practice their rights. And then the issue of sexual education for young girls so that they can take their informed decision. You'd find that in most of the African countries, if you talk about sexual education, usually they think you are promoting sexuality within the young women or the young girls. But this must be part of the curriculum at schools. I remember in Swaziland, we were proposing that sexuality should be part of the curriculum at school. The government, the parents were against that. I don't know how many minutes I have. But it is proper that we usually advocate for sexual education to our schools so that our young girls are protected. I thank you, Madam Chair. I'll respond to more questions.
Thank you, Sivive, very much for your presentation, especially on focusing on strategies, what should be done to address sexual reproductive rights of positive women. Our next speaker is going to be Vincent Chrysostomo. Yes, that's correct.
Perfect.
Yes, who represents Seven Sisters Coalition of Asia-Pacific Regional Networks on HIV/AIDS.
Thank you. And I do want to say that it is an honor to be on this panel because as the only man sitting up here, that I want to put out, whenever I speak publicly, I don't present myself as an expert. And that's because I hope that that suggests an openness and a willingness to learn. And I think in this particular topic, for other men in the field and for other even service providers, a willingness to learn is very important because otherwise we just end up perpetuating the same kinds of dynamics that we're actually trying to fight. So my talk is going to be in the context of Asia and the Pacific, what I've seen as the executive director of the Seven Sisters. Right off the bat when I took my job, I was attacked because what is something called Seven Sisters? Why is it being led by a man? I honestly didn't know what to say to that. All I could say was, the job announcement came out, I applied. It was a name that I inherited. I couldn't do anything about that. But it got me to thinking. I was pressed to form a women's network. And I said, but a women's network to do what? We have lots of women's networks to get out in Asia. The issue is that they're not working together. We're not working with them properly. So over the last few years, I've made it a priority to try to figure out what we could do to address this. And in 2008, something called the Commission on AIDS in Asia came out. And in this document, they had said that if you look at Asia has concentrated epidemics, but there's three characteristics. Unprotected sex between men, paid sex, and intravenous drug use. And if you looked at this, and also migration was another factor, but if you looked at these factors, that meant that over 55 million women in the region were at risk for HIV and AIDS. So what to do about this? So our coalition, Seven Sisters, we are five regional networks which represent key affected populations. And so I started to ask this question to my networks, and no one could really answer it. So what we have done... The other thing that happened is that I was chosen to be the Asia-Pacific delegate to the UN AIDS PCB board. And at that time, I don't know if you're familiar with this whole process, but there was it since has led to the operational framework on women and girls. But as an NGO delegate, I have to say I didn't know a lot about this, but here we are trying to create policies. And I had to learn very quickly. And I really wish Zoni was here because she taught me a lot. And I think it was the first time, she's not here, so I feel kind of funny talking about it, but we got into an argument, basically. And I asked her, I didn't understand what she was doing, and she just pointed out to me that this was her job. And I won't go into the whole details, but I realized that was the first time that I had ever been angry at another activist, and they actually made space for me to actually explain what and I actually realized I didn't know what I was doing. And it's... comes back to that willingness to learn, and Zoni actually mentored me a lot, I think. And I'm really grateful to her, and I really wish she was here, because she's become one of my favorite people. But in the meantime, I had to kind of operationalize this in Asia. So what I've done in our coalition is I've created a gender task force, we're calling it, and it's we're looking at how these dynamics play out in our networks. What are the areas that we can work together? Because we have sex workers, we have people who use drugs, we have a operational research on migration network. We have Asia-Pacific network of people living with HIV. There's a positive women's network in there. And then I also created a strategic partner with ICW Asia-Pacific. And so we bring them together, and we started to do this work with our UN UNAIDS and the co-sponsors called Intimate Partner Transmission. And this has been really important because we talk about sexual and reproductive health rights, but then when it comes to a policy level, you're actually not allowed to use the word rights in Southeast Asia, and I'm pretty sure in other countries. So how can you guarantee something if you can't talk about it? And there's a regional body which I was talking about sexual and reproductive health rights, and they said, Vince, we don't guarantee their human rights in anything else. Why would this be any different? You know, we don't want to give people false hope. And I was like, I thought about it, and he wasn't being malicious. This was just the way they think, you know. It's like, this is not guaranteed anything else, so why should this be any different? And I said, but this, I mean, Global Fund, UNAIDS, there's a lot of money out there that people get to guarantee that this is going to happen. And so we have started to work with our government partners in raising these questions. And so we have a coalition that's civil society, the UN co-sponsors. We have research being done at national and regional level to compile all these things. And we will start, hopefully, in the next few months to do a gender assessment of my networks, because many of the networks are pretty male-run. And, you know, I think I've already said this, but, you know, when you talk about human rights and you can't talk about it, what do you do? And I think there are other ways. And one of the things is just, I think, participation. And so has the director of Seven Sisters. I'm trying to always find ways that we can create so that women can participate. And often, you know, when they hear about what we're doing, we don't get a lot of enthusiasm because this is not something that we do in our cultures. But I find that if you can just find some way to connect what you're doing to what's happening in their lives, and a lot of times the women won't do it for themselves, but they'll do it for their children, their daughters. And we've gotten a lot of mileage for that, and it starts small. And then I was told also recently at one of our meetings that, you know, this is almost impossible. And I also think that you kind of have to shoot high here, because if you think really small and you fail, it's like, okay. But if you think you're going to fail to begin with, why don't you just, you know, let's just go for it and see what happens. Because he said, you know, we're trying to change cultural norms. You're trying to change the way our leaders think. This is never going to happen. And I said, well, it's not going to happen any sooner if that's the attitude that we take. You know, we really have to shift the way that we think and talk about this. And, you know, I'm glad to say I think our region is actually leading in this in terms of the work that's being done at the UN level. And I'm glad that our coalition is a part of that. We have... there's a number of other things that have happened. The very same organization that said that, you know, we don't guarantee their human rights in anything else, they've actually supported this coalition with a grant. And that's one of the things, you know, I think ultimately we see this intimate partner transmission thing as the empowerment of women. And how do you do that? We have to give them choices. We have to create opportunities for them to participate in their health. We have to listen to what they say. Because, you know, we have another thing with Seven Sisters. We have this thing called our minimum standard of involvement for civil society. And that's, they have to be able to influence a decision. You cannot just be passively consulted. You have to actually be able to influence a decision. And many of the governments are actually open to this. It also takes us all working together. I don't know if there's any UN people here, but sometimes the UN gets a little territorial. And, you know, if we're really going to do this, we have to kind of put those differences aside. And you have to make resources available to these community-based women's groups that are doing this work, because otherwise they're left to do it for free, and that's never going to happen. We are also trying to influence Global Fund grants so that they make sure they have a strong gender component. We are looking to make sure that they're included in every level of the response. And in our region, for key affected populations, which is normally drug users, men who have sex with men, and sex workers, we actually name women as one of our key affected populations because of the Commission on AIDS in Asia. And we are getting interest. It's starting small, but you know, we see some. And I'll wrap this up. But I'm from Guam, and it's a very small it's a very small community. And I used to think my work meant nothing because you never saw anything. But about 6 or 7 years ago, I came. I was there, and a waitress in the restaurant stopped me, and she said, "You're Vince." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "You don't remember me, but when I was 14, you came." She was in a detention home. She said, "You stopped by, and you gave me 15 minutes. And she said, "During that time, you counseled me, you told me about this thing. And I just want you to know that since that time, I've been arrested, I've been divorced, but I didn't get pregnant, and I didn't get HIV. Thank you very much." And this is just, you know, sometimes you don't see the big change. It happens very small. And I think in this time, if you can make a change individually, one by one, then eventually you get the bigger thing. So I just want to put that out there, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Vincent. Could I ask you a very short question? I suppose that many of us would be interested to find out why seven sisters?
Okay. You might not think this is funny, but from what I heard is that they were all sisters. The first seven, initially it was seven networks. It was founded in 2001, and then they said they were all sisters, even the men. And so it became an affectionate thing. And I actually tried to lose the name because it doesn't translate very well in Southeast Asian languages, but I'm kind of stuck with it because people remember it. And
okay, thank you very much. Before asking Sarah to speak, I just quick check up. Are you hearing well? Okay, because I'm hearing this sound from here, but okay, so that's good. At least you hear. Our next speaker is going to be Sarah Sippel from Center for Health and Gender Equity Change, based in Washington, D.C. Yes, Sarah.
And I think I have PowerPoint, so.
Okay.
Okay. Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay, good. Well, first, thank you to the chairs, Mabel and Wanda, for putting together this session to Women Arise. And I think this issue of sexual reproductive health and rights in the context of HIV and AIDS is so important. So I'm delighted that they're highlighting it here. I want to first, let me see if I can, yeah, okay. So my organization, the Center for Health and Gender Equity, we're based in Washington, D.C., as Wanda said, and we promote sexual and reproductive health and rights within U.S. foreign policy and assistance. And I wanted to start with these photos of women we visited in Ethiopia, Botswana, Dominican Republic, because the work that we do in Washington is informed by the impact of U.S. policies and assistance on women and girls in developing countries and the countries that receive U.S. foreign assistance. And we believe it's very critical and believe that promoting the advocacy we do in Washington, D.C., to legitimize that we have to include the women who are most impacted by decisions that are made in Washington. So we target the U.S. Congress, the administration, to make sure that they're hearing or try to make them hear as best we can from the women on the ground. I want to talk today about the recently launched U.S. Global Initiative, Health Initiative, that was launched by the Obama administration in 2009. And what it does is it's to building on the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, also known as PEPFAR, which is the U.S. global response to AIDS. And the idea is to shift U.S. policy and funding around global health issues in a linked and coordinated way, and looking at specific health issues, HIV/AIDS, family planning, maternal health, TB, malaria, and neglected tropical diseases. And the initiative, from our perspective, presents a real possibility for the U.S. to be bold and strategic in its efforts to work with the international community to implement the ICPD, the International Conference on Population Development Program of Action, really ensuring access to sexual and reproductive health services for all, and doing so by adopting this sexual reproductive health and rights framework that was developed at the ICPD in 1994, which the U.S. government did sign on to and joined in that consensus, yet to this day it has not adopted that framework within its policies. HIV and AIDS, maternal and infant mortality, poor sexual reproductive health, these are all interconnected issues. They do not exist separately from each other and should not be addressed that way. HIV contributed to 60,000 maternal deaths in 2008. Despite increases in contraceptive use over the past 30 years, we still have significant contraceptive needs remaining unmet in regions, in all regions of the world. And these needs exist among people wishing to avoid HIV as well as those who are living with HIV. And we have to mention violence against women, which is also a critical aspect in this in terms of contributing to the widespread high rates of unintended pregnancies and unsafe abortions. So the GHI's basic tenets recognize these factors and that lead to poor sexual and reproductive health. It calls for programs to be country-led, to be woman and girl-centered, and integrated and coordinated. So we have a lot of hope in this approach. As a country-led initiative, the GHI has the potential to work in concert with civil society, with national governments, as well as regional sexual and reproductive health plans and frameworks, such as the African Maputo Plan of Action, and which would align financial and technical assistance coming from international donors like the U.S. with the national and regional priorities of those countries, yet also would include the civil society, which are so often left out. With women-centered programs and girl-centered programs, the GHI recognizes that no global health plan will be effective until it addresses the inequalities, disparate needs, and conditions of women and girls. And with a comprehensive and integrated approach, it recognizes that women are whole human beings with a right to holistic health care and should be treated as such. So all seems well and good with the Global Health Initiative in terms of it being country-led, women and girls-centered, integrated. These are all things that came out of the ICPD that we look forward to seeing happen with U.S. government policy, yet we still face many barriers that will prevent it from being implemented effectively if we as advocates do not address these issues. So a comprehensive and integrated approach, for example, to global health is critical, and the barriers to policy and funding really need to be overcome to make this implemented correctly. The current approach of the U.S., which addresses HIV/AIDS, maternal health, and family planning, these are all funded separately and they're programmed separately. For example, in Botswana, it's a country that receives PEPFAR funding for HIV/AIDS and no family planning funding from the United States government. And when I was in Botswana, I visited a national program funded by PEPFAR that was intended to work on issues of prevention of vertical transmission of HIV. The program focused on women living with HIV who were pregnant. However, it did not include any information or services related to voluntary family planning. Similarly, in an HIV testing program, even though many of the clients were sexually active, young people as well as adults, they were sexually active, but they did not include any information on family planning, maternal health, not even counseling, not even referrals of where they could seek these services. So while the mandate of programs like these that we saw in Botswana is HIV/AIDS related, the realities and concerns of women and girls and their reproductive health needs and decision-making were not taken into account. These programs only addressed one aspect of their lives, not taking into account the barriers that women face, such as a lack of legal protection for rape and stigma faced by pregnant women living with HIV, and missing really important opportunities to help reduce risk of illness and death related to sex and reproduction. So it's really critical that the U.S. government look at ways that they can make sure that even if the funding stays in these silos, how do they make sure that when the funding goes to the ground, that it's actually integrated and is not prohibitive? Even if there's no family planning money in a PEPFAR-funded country, how does that work? So that is something that the government is going to have to address. Another challenge is to the GHI will be the integration, coordination of maternal health, family planning, HIV/AIDS. When decisions are made about U.S. programs, the voices and perspectives of women have to be included. So the women-centered approach means that the U.S. government on the ground at the USAID missions have to be proactively reaching out to women's groups who traditionally are left out of decision-making at the mission level. And especially, we're calling for them to reach out to women living with HIV and other women who face stigma, whether it's from sex work, disabilities, indigenous women, incarcerated women, that the U.S. must, to have a truly woman-centered approach, they have to reach out to these women. Another issue is unsafe abortion. In Ethiopia in 2005, the Ethiopian government changed their law around abortion to decriminalize it in cases of rape, incest, the life of the mother, and other cases. However, the U.S. government has restrictions on its funding, so it cannot be used for safe, legal abortions. Even though in Ethiopia it's legal, in the United States it's legal, there are barriers that the U.S. Congress has put in place. And we need to address those barriers because the unsafe abortion rates are way too high. It's a third of the maternal deaths in Ethiopia are caused by unsafe abortion. So they must go addressed. I don't want to take up too much time. The funding and silos that we see, or I'll say briefly on abstinence, and the Abstinence Be Faithful programs still continue under the Obama administration, even though the Obama administration purports that it does support comprehensive prevention, but why are we still funding abstinence fidelity programs? Additionally, we have the anti-prostitution loyalty oath that's attached to HIV/AIDS funding, which means that if an organization receives HIV funding from the U.S. government, they have to have a policy that opposes prostitution. And that's a stipulation that was put in place by the U.S. Congress. And has created all sorts of problems on the ground in terms of public health, really undermining public health best practices, and so it has impacted service provision. And then, barriers, there are those are the laws, the policies, the structural problems that we have in implementing a successful GHI. We also have in the U.S. our advocacy community in Washington is very fragmented. We work on HIV/AIDS, we work on family planning, maternal health. How do we, if we want to move the U.S. government towards an integrated, woman-centered approach, we really need to do a better job working together. And really, we're pitted against each other because these funding streams are separate. And I think we would be so much stronger. We'd be stronger asking for a bigger pie all across the board if we work together and join forces on these issues. And finally, the challenge of the donor community that funds our advocacy organizations are also in silos. So the problem is not just the government; it's bigger and broader than that. So what you can do, we have, the U.S. government came out with the 8 countries that they're going to focus on to learn from the GHI implementation. And those are Ethiopia, Rwanda, Kenya, Malawi, Mali, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Guatemala. And the idea, the Global Health Initiative in these countries, the U.S. government is looking to learn from what works, what doesn't work, so they can scale up best practices. So what we need to know, we need to hold the U.S. accountable for how they're implementing this GHI. So we need to know, how is a woman-centered approach being implemented in these countries? What does it look like? What does it mean? Are women being consulted in the design, development, implementation, and monitoring of these programs? How is the U.S. involving civil society? Are women's rights, human rights, LGBT rights organizations being consulted? Are sex workers being consulted in a meaningful way? And a lot of times, the U.S. government at the mission level rely on the international NGOs to get a sense of civil society. And what we're saying is you have to go beyond the international NGOs to the ground and really reach out and be proactive in gathering that information. And that, to us, is what's going to make it a truly country-led program. And then finally, how is integration happening? Are programs being designed from the perspective of the client as opposed to the implementers and the service providers? Is it just what's convenient and easiest for the provider rather than what is the need of the woman, the girl, the man walking into the clinic? So as advocates, we have a lot to do. We need to partner with the groups on the ground so that we, being advocacy groups in Washington, because we need to know what's happening so that we can make these changes in Washington. If changes need to be made, we need to say this works, this doesn't work, and to link them up with those of you on the ground. And, of course, we need to get rid of these barriers that I mentioned earlier, the anti-prostitution loyalty oath, abstinence be faithful only programming, and the siloed programming, and we need to be joined together on that. And I think I'll close for now and just really thanking Mabel for pulling together this Women Arise Coalition, because I think because the work that Change does is woman-centered, and then what does that really mean, and who are these women? And Women Arise has done a tremendous job bringing women together from the different communities, working on the different health issues, and really talking about rights for women in a really authentic way in terms of the voices. So I would, as the T-shirt says, you know, we are women, we're positive, we're negative, we're sex workers, we're drug users, we're indigenous, we're disabled, we're caregivers, we're young, we're old. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And I think we have to stop and recognize that when we say the word women, we're talking about a very diverse group of people. And so and makes it challenging for not only policymakers, but also for ourselves as advocates. And I don't think it's that hard for us to really speak in that broad way. I think a lot of times we're all caught up in our silos, and it's like, well, I can't really take on this issue or that issue. And I think really incorporating it into the work that we do by partnering, developing these authentic partnerships to lift each other up and to really be a true united voice. So thank you, and I'll end there.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah, for sharing your experience about the U.S. policies. And actually, I must say that what you said is very close to our experience at the UN, that the U.S. Did not immediately dramatically change their policies at the UN as many of us did expect it happened. This is like a very slow, gradual process, but, well, it's still far, a long way to go. Okay, thank you. And our next speaker is going to be Eugenia Lopez. She represents Balance Promoción para el Desarrollo Juventud. Sorry.
Is this on? Yeah. It's Balance Promoting Development and Youth. That's the name in English. Well, I'm going to present a political mapping that we made in Latin America in 8 countries. And what we did is that we know that we have the international commitment of giving universal reproductive health universal access for reproductive health, but there's a little going on how does this apply to women living with HIV. So we did that. And we're based on, this is just for you to know. We're based in the Glion commitment. We do know that there are four key actions that have been on the global arena as strategical to address the women response. And the first one is primary prevention of HIV infection of women. The second one is prevention of unintended pregnancies in women with HIV. The third one is prevention of transmission from women living with HIV to their infants. And the fourth one is provision of care, treatment, and support for women living with HIV and their families. And as we know, everything is just focused on the third one. And we need to stop doing that, and we need to start thinking about human rights that include sexual and reproductive rights of women living with HIV. What did we found? Well, there are no policies in Latin America that are focused on women. There's just this mentioning sometimes of them, but there's no policies addressing women or primary HIV prevention among women. The specific actions are just for pregnant women and sexual workers, and even those activities that are addressed on key populations are not differentiated by gender. So when we speak about migrants, when we speak about, for instance, when we speak about MSM, we never speak about the female partners of MSM. So we're not addressing women at all. And survivors of gender violence, despite we do know the linkages between violence and HIV, are not addressed either. So this is like an overview of the eight countries and the HIV plans. And as you can see, there are very little mentions on women, and they are for, as I said, pregnant women and sexual workers. There's no prevention for young women. So we do know that part of the problem is that there is a lack of political will to support the prevention with women. But we also know that the access to prenatal HIV prevention is also under the idea that women are not part of the population living with HIV, and we know that we are not addressing the prenatal care as we are supposed to. So we know that we are still seeing women just as vectors. And the policies that are made in Latin America and in the most of the countries are based on this idea of women as vectors. And by the other hand, the reality is that offering the HIV test during pregnancy is the only real opportunity for heterosexual women to be tested and to know their diagnosis and to have access to treatment. As we all know, it's very usual that women realize that they live with HIV after their male partner has died or is very sick in the hospital. We have also discovered that when you do offer women the test of HIV during pregnancy and you accompany that with counseling, women do accept to be tested and women do realize that's a good thing for themselves. We're speaking about how to improve the health of women if they are pregnant or if they are not pregnant. But this is a good opportunity to know your status and to have access to diagnosis and treatment. Now, this slide is very interesting because it shows how the feminist movement has achieved very important successes on sexual and reproductive rights, but these are not reflected on women with HIV. In the national HIV plans, there's no mention to assisted adoption. And as we know, that should be an option because women living with HIV and men living with HIV can decide to have children, and one option is to have adoption. Another option is assisted reproduction, and they are not mentioned. Just Nicaragua mentions family planning as part of the HIV policy, and there are just two countries, Colombia and Guatemala, that will actually address sexual and reproductive health for women living with HIV. Remember, this is what is in paper. There's a gap on reality, but even in paper, this slide shows how we are not addressing sexual and reproductive rights of women living with HIV at all. So we also know that the only contraception that is offered for women is condoms, and that in the majority, well, we will see, but just Mexico speaks about feminine condom. The rest of the countries have gave up. And we found that despite the fact that WHO emphasized that women that are not having a family planning method shouldn't be taking efavirenz, because as you know, it has a congenital malformation as consequence. In many of Latin American countries, efavirenz is the usual drug taken by women in reproductive age. And that takes us again to unwanted and unplanned pregnancies. And we know that in the whole region, abortion is a big deal and is causing a lot of deaths and morbidity among women. You can see that the first quote is my favorite. Doctors actually think that if a woman lives with HIV and they want to have a baby, they are kind of crazy, right? So this is the statistic with the female condom, just Mexico, and there's no relation with diagnosis and treatment of other STIs and cancer, cervical cancer, or breast cancer. It's just HIV, and they don't link with any other sexual and reproductive issue. I just want to emphasize that we're not advancing on sexual and reproductive rights and health for women living with HIV. Even though in Latin America, sexual and reproductive health and rights had been advanced by the feminist movement, this is not impacting women living with HIV in the real life. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Evgenia, and I think it's so important that we have this real information coming from a survey, because usually in Latin America those things are not even considered, okay? And we know that as specifically in Chile, that you were not mentioned here, this country, but is a great fight, because women are sterilized because they want not to be having children. Positive women need to be sterilized, and even without any consent. And in many of our countries, as it was shown there. But so this is one of the problems we are having still there. And it's a pity what we obtained for the general women. We still are not able to have for the positive women, and now the positive young women. Okay? And this is. So, thank you so much. Now, I invite Wanda Nowiska from Astra, because we have had another person talking from Astra, that is Senia Malian, but she has a problem with the plane. She couldn't arrive. We hope tomorrow she's coming, but she's not going to be able here. So we ask Wanda, because this is a conference in Europe and is for Eastern Europe, so important that we have their voices. So, Wanda, thank you.
Thank you, Mabel. I'm really sorry Zenia could not come for our session. Her plane has been cancelled. She'll be here tomorrow, and you will have a chance to meet her and hear her, listen to her on Wednesday Astra panel, which will be specifically sacrificed to issues of Central and Eastern Europe. I came here to the podium not because I'm having a PowerPoint presentation, but I wanted to make a distinction between my role as a co-chair and the role as an ad hoc speaker. As you can imagine, my presentation hasn't been prepared long time ago. But I want to look at this very negative situation that Zenia is not here from a positive side, and then to not to speak about Armenia as she would speak if she were here today, but to give you some highlights of the issues related to women and sexual reproductive health and rights in our region. So let me first start with the introduction of Astra Network, Astra Central and Eastern European Women's Network for Sexual and Reproductive Health and Rights, has been active since 1999, and it consists of 25 organizations from our region, from 17 countries. And Astra is basically advocating for sexual reproductive health and rights at international arena, at regional arena, especially European Union, and also at the national level. And from the very beginning, we saw the issue of HIV as very inherent subject of sexual and reproductive health and rights. Those of you who work in the field of sexual reproductive health and rights, you probably remember the times when HIV has been seen as completely unrelated to sex and sexuality-related issues. I remember my experience from Poland when we were organizing some street actions to promote condoms, and we were told by HIV main agency, but don't say that condoms can be used for to prevent unwanted pregnancy. They're only to prevent HIV virus. But so now the situation is changing. We see more and more of integration of HIV as really integral part of the package. Although nobody can say that HIV is a positive phenomenon, but I think we can look at this as a chance to strengthen sexual reproductive rights policies, which we haven't succeeded yet for so many years, but in the context of HIV pandemic, it gives us more fuel to be more demanding on our rights. And speaking of women, we at Astra for a couple of years adopted the strategy, which is very unique in our region. I know it's quite quite strong in other parts of the world, but in our region there hasn't been any integration of women's movement and HIV, especially women, positive women from our region. They are like two separate movements, and for a couple of years we've been trying to make this integration, and actually we believe that both communities have a lot to offer to each other. Let me just highlight a couple of issues that came out as very important for our region during two preparatory meetings we had for this conference with positive women. Certainly one of the major issues for the region is increasing percentage of women who have been who contracted virus via sexual way. As you probably are aware of the fact, until very recently, HIV pandemic in the region has been associated with drug use. This is not the case anymore. More and more women, especially young women, are contracting HIV via sexual intercourse. And economic migration, which is very characteristic for our region, and in the countries and between the countries, especially of countries of former Soviet Union, causes a lot of challenges for people there, especially women. Many men are traveling for jobs to Russia or to other countries. Women are left at home, and then men are coming back, and they are bringing also the pandemic, the virus home. And very often women are not aware of that until they, for example, are having a baby, and they are going to health clinic, and all of a sudden many of them find out that they are infected. So that's very typical problem for women in the region. Moreover, there are a lot of problems related to migration that people that sometimes couples, some of them, they are having citizenship in one country of the region, and her partner or his partner is having citizenship in another country. And in those countries, you cannot access health services if you are not a citizen of the given country. So there is a lot of problem regarding access to health care. Moreover, in many societies of Central and Eastern Europe, there is a culture of silence that surrounded sex, that dictates that good women are expected to be ignorant about sex and passive in sexual interactions. This makes it difficult for women to be informed about risk reduction, or even when informed, make it difficult for them to be proactive in negotiating a safer sex. The traditional norm of virginity for unmarried girls that exists in many societies paradoxically increases young women's risk of infection, because it restricts their ability to ask for information about sex out of fear that they will be thought to be sexually active. Virginity also puts young girls at risk of rape and sexual coercion in high prevalence countries because of the erroneous belief that sex with a virgin can cleanse a man of infection, and because of the erotic imagery that surrounds the innocence and passivity associated with virginity. In addition, in cultures where virginity is highly valued, research has shown that some young women practice alternative sexual behaviors in order to preserve their virginity, although these behaviors may place them in increased risk of HIV. because of the strong norms of virginity and the culture of silence that surrounds sex, accessing treatment services for sexually transmitted diseases can be highly stigmatizing for adolescents and adult women. In many cultures, because motherhood, like virginity, is considered to be a feminine ideal, using barrier methods or non-penetrative sex as safer sex options present a significant dilemma for women. Women's economic dependency increases their vulnerability to HIV. Research has shown that the economic vulnerability of women makes it more likely that they will exchange sex for money or favors, less likely that they will succeed in negotiating protection, and less likely that they will leave a relationship that they perceive to be risky. Anyway, though, there are many other problems associated with that, but now let me focus in my last part of the presentation on what needs to be done in order to overcome these problems. First of all, what we really need is a critical mass of women sitting at the tables where decisions are being made about policies and funding priorities. We need more women. We need more women from our region where policies regarding HIV pandemics are being discussed. We need also to allocate funding for prevention, treatment, which are, of course, directly related to HIV, but also to programs empowering women, because we know very well, without empowering women, without until we deal with subordinate social status of women, we will not change the pandemic. We will not decrease the pandemic. We also have to address human rights of women, positive women, but also women who might be positive as well in healthcare. One of the problems we observe that many women due to strong stigma around HIV, many women have problems with accessing healthcare unrelated to HIV. This is a huge problem of our region. So, right to dignity, right to confidentiality, which is a huge issue in the region, of course, and the right to decision making and to information. And of course, prevention, sexuality education as early as possible, full access to contraceptives, including condoms, including women's condoms. And finally, we have to hold government accountable for so many promises they've made. And it's as we Women's Arise, which Astra is also part of, we believe it's over. The time for talks is finished. Now we need action. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And as you mentioned, Rwanda, the time to talk finished. Now we need actions. We require and we are going to claim for actions. So now we have some time for you to make questions, comments, share some experiences and so on. We have the microphones there, so if you want to go there. Is anyone? No one?
Microphone?
Yeah, you can use it.
Hello? Yes? I'm Michiel Anderweg from the Dutch organization Choice for Youth and Sexuality. And if we really look to what could be a concrete action point on this moment, and I think it would be to have universal access to the female condom, because then you have the woman herself can make the choice. With that, you give her a lot of power to have her own guarantee over sexual and reproductive rights. And I think that it's very important that that should be included in the sexual education as well. So that's my point. Thank you.
Any of you want to respond? Yeah. Excellent.
I agree, but I actually think you need to give more options than the female condom, because what you'll have happen is you will have them make the female condom available, but it'll be somewhere where women can't access it, and the governments will tell you that it's available. So I think you need to advocate for a variety, because the more choices you can give women, the more empowered they're going to be to make choices. Because even if you make it available in some countries in Asia, women aren't going to get that. So I think you need to think broader than the female condom. Like, there's something right now, pre-exposure prophylaxis, where they're looking at pills, possibly creams or gels that could prevent. I think that would give women more control over what's happening, because it could be done in a way that's not so, like, I think a cream or a microbicide, you can put that in things that can be hidden. Because in our region, if a woman is found to be taking pills, either for birth control or whatever, without the permission of her husband, she could get killed in some countries. And so I think you really, when, you know, I think the female condom is great, but I think you really need to be broader in your advocacy and around strategies.
Thank you. And thanks for bringing up the issue of female condoms. I agree. We need, there's no magic bullet, obviously, and we need a whole spectrum of choices for women. And even when microbicides and vaccines become available, they'll be only so effective. I think they're saying 30% for the first generation of microbicides. So we're going to need female condoms. We need male condoms. We need women to have these choices. And female condoms are a product that it's effective, it's available today, yet it's not accessible. And that is a crime, and that we need to really have it available today as a tool for women to negotiate and to have conversations around sex. And studies have shown that when it is introduced, that sex lives do improve, because it forces communication. It's not something that you can hide. So I think for those women who need to hide, who don't need to hide, I mean, it's really about choices, but also about having the opportunity to negotiate. And one of my concerns when we talk about, in terms of microbicides and such, that we need to make sure that that women can't. I think I was thinking of the treatment as prevention, and this idea of if we jump on all of these technology boats that are passing by and forget about female condoms, the danger is that we miss this opportunity for women, for education with young people, with women, to really have that opportunity to negotiate and to initiate safer sex.
Sifi would want to say something, but go ahead, and she's going to say later.
Oh, okay. Before I make my comment, just getting back to what Sarah said about microbicides, I think new prevention technologies are very important. But one thing that we don't know yet about microbicides, if they will offer bidirectional protection, and if they will protect against other STIs. So we definitely need to keep the female condom and the male condom at the forefront. My question to the panel is, we keep saying that we need to have women at the table, we need to have young women, we need to have positive women, but where do you see prescriptive guidance for government or for other funding sources or streams to make sure that we have capacity building? Because what happens is sometimes we have women at the table, we have women who have experiential knowledge, but because they can't articulate what that knowledge is, what those experiences were, and because they can't be prescriptive in their guidance, not because they're not passionate and not because they are not empowered on some level, but there's a skill deficit, there's a knowledge deficit. So how do we make these women able to come to the table and be active and meaningful participants? Next question is, as we talk about sexual and reproductive health and rights, good policy is nothing without good communication and good application. So when we're talking about how do we take it from not only stigma indexes and policy regulations and guidance, but how do we actually reach providers on the ground? Because we know how to prevent not mother-to-child transmission, because that vilifies women, but we know how to prevent vertical transmission. But somehow we're missing the mark in making sure that providers are able to suspend their moral judgment and make sure that women actually get the messages, that it's articulated, that it's clear and that there are bidirectional relationships and conversations between providers and women. So I want us to think on a macro level, but I also want us to think on a micro level about not how only do we put policy in place, but how do we turn policy into practice?
Thank you for the comments. Maybe on the first comments on the availability of female condom, that is a crucial issue in Africa on the issue of availability, let alone on how to use the female condom. That is another problem we are facing, whereby we need to make sure that there is this social marketing of female condom. Women are taught how or are empowered on how to use the female condom so that at least they can negotiate for a safer sex. And then on the skilled or on the capacity of women participating in policies or in programs, I usually say when I'm talking to women, nobody has been born with capacity or skilled. Everybody has to be trained in order to be capacitated or in order to make sure that there is meaningful involvement or participation. Even as we're talking about the women's rights and issues, we were never born like this. We were trained. So we were empowered. It is very much important that we empower the women. We make sure that the women, they know when we talk about policies, what are policies. But what has fascinated so far, as we were presenting here, most of our countries, they don't have policies that are protecting women's rights. That is the issue that we should be looking at. How do we advocate for the policies or the legislations that should protect the women's rights? I was listening from the paper presentation from my sister. It's worse than you can think of USA promoting the human rights. It's very worse. What are the civil society organizations doing in USA to make sure that women are protected? You talk about vertical transmission of HIV and AIDS. Most of the programs are concentrating on the infant or the baby. What is happening with the mother? Because we should also make sure that the mother is catered by the program, the PMTCT. It takes care of the baby. The mother is not involved in the PMTCT. Thank you.
Hello. I like your comment about how to go to the micro, from the micro level to the micro level. And I think that's something very important to think about. What we found in the research is that women living with HIV who are leaders are now the ones that are taking the responsibility of giving counseling and support to the women at the health system. And they are doing it for free with their own time, even though they don't have a job and they have problems to live, right, to earn a living. So it is very important that that we build stronger systems that do recognize women living with HIV as resources, as a part of the response, but that can also recognize that they should be paid and that they have experience that is important. It's not an experience that the school gives you, but it's a very, very important experience for the community. And by the other side, I've been very worried about the lack of information, of actual information that health providers actually have on HIV and prevention. No, it's like this big conference with all this experience, they don't reach real health providers at the local level. So we must do something to ensure that they are trained and that they are actualized.
Thank you. Before passing to them, we invite you to make your comment, question, or whatever. Okay. If you want to speak, sorry, stand up there. He's going to speak first.
Okay. My name is Jose Diaz from Puerto Rico, and I want to know if you see the possibility of groups of men working with the women who are in the fight for the challenges for women and girls with HIV and AIDS.
Excellent. Can you make your question or comment, please, and then we move?
Okay. I want just to say the situation which is in our country, still European country, the main problem is absence of sexuality education. The people in the age, not only teenager, even in the young age, they don't know nothing, not about sexual transmitted diseases and about HIV. Even today, the board guy, when I go to the passport control, they ask, where you are going? We told in the HIV conference, and he told them, how to prevent? What have I to do? He was about 30 years old. It was so strange, but it was closed Soviet system. Nobody speak about this, and even today, nobody speak. And no, not only the community, even the doctors does not know what to do with the people which H-positive women or men, what to do, how to treat. And so the doctors also need information about this. Community need information and show the faces of H-positive women that they are not danger for the society and they are the all members of the whole community. Even they have discrimination and stigma in the family because they are afraid to be together, to eat together, to speak together. And it must be make awareness, and mass media must take a big role on this. And, of course, everything must go through education.
Thank you. Can we start with Sarah coming from here? Yes. All the answers? Yeah. Thank you.
I didn't hear the first question. I wasn't able to hear with that.
About the men?
About the men, yeah.
Yeah. How is it possible that
we
the men could...
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, for us, it's critical to include men in... Sorry? To the women's AIDS response, how to include men. I think it's interesting because I think of this question similar to the question that we get a lot from young people in terms of how can we get a seat at the table, how can we be a part of this movement. And I would just say just step in and step up and join. And I think it's critical for men to be publicly visible and vocal about sexual reproductive health and rights, because it impacts men just as much as women. And so I think in terms of, and it, I think it would also really help us in terms of making the links with HIV/AIDS and reproductive health, because when we're talking similar to what I was saying, these issues are interconnected in women's lives, HIV/AIDS, maternal health, family planning, and I think with sex being the common denominator there when we're talking about sexual transmission, it's really critical to have men at the table, young people at the table, and again, it's we have to kind of get out of our comfort zones, and I would say women too, getting out of our comfort zones and joining and supporting other movements that we may not be a part of, but share the long-term vision. And so I think it's definitely doable. I don't think there's, you know, this is 1, 2, 3, the steps in how to make it happen. But I think, conferences like this are really key to raise these issues and to really step out of our comfort zones. I'm thinking of myself personally, to step out and engage and have these conversations and be more welcoming of others. So thank you. And sex ed is... I think that on the last comment is just so critical. This is an issue across the globe. It's an issue in the United States in terms of how do we get information and services to the young people. And it's really changing cultures, attitudes, and we really need to do some values clarification around sex in general, that this is in all of our countries that we're dealing with this. And I think the United States being a major donor on international family planning and HIV/AIDS has an important role to play. If we're going to do this country-led approach to the Global Health Initiative, they can't. That doesn't mean that a country says to the United States government, "Well, sorry, we're not going to do sex education." And the United States has to be prepared to respond, and that's where we need civil society to really push the U.S. government and other international donors to demand sex education for young people, no matter where it is. Thank you.
Okay. In Asia, we actually have a coalition that just started, and I actually sent Mabel a newsletter that has the address of this group. But they're actually documenting best practices in the Asia region for involving men and stopping gender violence. Also in involving men, this intimate partner transmission project that I talked about earlier, last year we did some mapping and we found that you have to start early. You have to teach men, like a man should not learn or a boy should not learn that it's wrong to hit or do any kind of violence once they've already done it. It needs to start early. It needs to start in the schools. And so this takes working with the Department of Education. And then the other thing is that what you said about the capacity building, the other thing that came up, what we found out when we were talking to health providers, actually of service providers who do sexual and reproductive health, was that they also needed capacity building because in the Asian culture, we don't talk about sex. We don't talk about a lot of these things, and they felt that they needed their own kind of sensitizing because otherwise they wouldn't be able to bring it up. And many of them, it was quite emotional because they would see women who would come who experienced violence and they couldn't do anything because they themselves didn't know because they don't have a space to talk about it. So they said one thing that we could do was to convene groups where they could talk about these issues and identify what could be done. And the other thing is that the capacity building is really important. And when I said earlier about the female condom, in our region also, in many countries, it's illegal for a woman to have a condom. She'd be arrested as a sex worker, and that's wrong. I mean, I think everybody would agree with that. But what we've tried to do is we tried to create these mentoring programs where we've picked senior activists from the feminist movement, from different coalitions, from the HIV, to mentor up-and-coming. And we've gotten our technical support facility from UNAIDS to actually support this a couple of times. And, I mean, it's a small step, but sometimes if you're going to wait for the governments, you're going to be waiting an awful long time. So, you know, we try to see what we can do in the meantime.
I also wanted to address the issue of capacity building and mentoring, but I will take a slightly different take on this issue. I wish we all were that privileged that we will have trainings before starting our job, but in practice we usually start our work and we do advocacy before we have a chance to have any kind of a training. And I think what is really key, this is critical mass of women wherever we work, and then mentoring by practice. I think we learn by practice. Of course, it's great to have trainings if possible, but we shouldn't be intimidated by the fact if we don't have those trainings, but we have women around who already know how to do it and can teach us to do it, by practice, not by theory. So although we do a lot of trainings in Astra ourselves as well, but we know that the best learning experience is just doing the work.
Evgenia, please.
Well, one thing that I want to say is that we need to realize that the response to HIV is with many different movements, and we need to involve all of them. Men, women, MSM. I mean, it's like we really need to strengthen the response, linking together and building together and not making any other movement invisible, but making the linkage and the articulation. And the other thing is that we must come back to pleasure and to understand that if somebody is diagnosed with HIV, it doesn't mean that person is not going to have sex, or that person is not going to have children, or that person came up. That person is still a real person, and she or he has the same rights that the rest of the people, and the state has to ensure those rights. And we as activists must ensure that the state guarantees those rights.
So maybe before CPP, could you...
Thank you very much.
We are going to
participation with yours.
Can I continue?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. My name is Viola Onwuleri from Nigeria, from the organization Women Development and Community Health Projects. I want to address the issue of skills mentioned by the young lady, and I want to support her views that we need to train the younger ones. Yes, you can do it through experience, but you're more confident when you are trained. It's also easier and you achieve better results when you have undergone a formal training. For now, there are areas or organizations that do this training, capacity building. And when you come to conferences like this, for the younger ones, it's also of great benefit if you attend the skills building workshops in addition to sessions like this. But you benefit a great deal if you attend skills building workshops and focus on areas where you lack capacity to get trained. In these days of electronic age too, you can get a lot of training models, you know, from the internet. And that is all in addition to opportunities of face-to-face training. So I think it's important that we do that for those of us that are passionate about women issues. We're in this hall now, we are treating a very important thing that touches on all women. And we are not here. The women are not here, the men are not here. And that shows how serious we are about this. But for those who are serious about women issues, it's important that they get trained. And I also want to suggest that in addition to these sessions, even the various women groups can mount skills sessions at conferences like this so that the younger ones who are coming will learn to be part of it and do it better. Thank you very much.
There are skilling building sessions.
Thank you very much for the contribution. Actually, as I'm saying thank you very much for the contribution towards skilled building workshop, whereby we need the young people to be empowered. I think when we are from our countries and we have young people, this is what we can do, we can promote. And my last comment, because this is the last... My last comment, I would say thank you very much for attending this workshop. It is very much important that as the advocates, feminists, activists, women's organization representative, we should promote the issues of sexual and reproductive rights. I know in Africa, if you talk about human rights, you are talking about the monster that they don't want to hear about. But it is important as we continue. I usually say one time I was, when we were in the UN meeting, most of the people were talking about men involvement. My problem with men involvement, I would say, look at the UN Secretary Generals. How many women have been appointed since the initiation of this organization? All the Secretary Generals are men, whereas they are saying there is affirmative action, equity, what. Now we have to start with the UN. The next woman should be, the next Secretary General should be a woman. We advocate for that. Thank you.
So, thank you so much. And we want to invite all of you to go to the plenary. And there, Women Arise, we are going to be there. You could ask one of these T-shirts, and we are going to be there all together to demonstrate how we need now to come back to action now for women and girls. So I invited also the men to come with us and to have these on the hands, because we want to have only the women with the T-shirts. You could have the T-shirts, but we want only the women there, okay? But you could have these, and we are very happy to have all of you. Thank you so much. See you. And we invited also to go every day at 10:30, 4:30 to our stand. The booth in the exhibition is 422, and we are going to have some play and win. Okay? Thank you.